headlines. A top election official in the U.S. state of Georgia urges Donald Trump to stop inciting violence by his claims that last month's presidential vote was rigged. A senior U.S. government official reportedly blames Israel for the assassination of Iran's renowned nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Also coming up, a UN official says some 20,000 foreign fighters and mercenaries are still in Libya, describing the situation as a shocking violation of the country's sovereignty. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, an election official in the U.S. state of Georgia says President Donald Trump has to stop provoking people to commit potential acts of violence.
It's too much. Yes, fight for every legal vote. Go through your due process. We encourage you. Use your First Amendment. That's fine. Death threats. Physical threats. Intimidation. It's too much. It's not right. They've lost the moral high ground to claim that it is.
Gabe Sterling added that some state officials have received the death threats. Trump has so far refused to concede defeat, saying last month's presidential election was rigged. His campaign has requested a second recount in Georgia, where he narrowly lost to his Democratic rival Joe Biden. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger said no evidence of widespread fraud had been found to support the president's claims. Trump has called Raffensperger, quote, an enemy of people. The state of Georgia will also hold in January two runoffs elections, which will determine who controls the Senate. And political commentator Frank Gemsbach says Trump's strategy is to repeat this message again and again, that the election was rigged and he's the leader to save the nation through this crisis.
I think that what he is doing is what is called the big lie. If you say things often enough and you're important enough and it's crazy enough and so out of sync, people begin to believe it. We know this. And once you get to a point like we have, where 40% or more, maybe of the entire population, and 70% of the people who voted for Trump feel the election is illegitimate, feel that the election has been stolen because they've heard it and heard it and heard it, then you have a situation where people take action. They don't have to be told to take action. They believe they're defending the country. And you set up a situation where the country becomes ungovernable and needs a strong leader like Trump. That's what he is after here. I think it's been clearer and clearer that the strategy is a destructive one for our country. And people in the Republican Party are going to have to stand up for it if we're going to be able to function in the future.
A senior U.S. government official has told CNN that Israel was behind the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The official was quoted as saying that Fakhrizadeh had been a target for Israelis for a long time. The official, however, declined to give details about whether the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump knew about the attack before it was carried out or provided support. Earlier, the New York Times also cited a U.S. official as saying that Israel was behind the murder. Iran has blamed Israel for the killing, saying the terror attack bore the hallmarks of the regime's spy agency. Fakhrizadeh was assassinated near the capital, Tehran, on Friday. The killing has drawn a slew of condemnations from senior officials from across the world. Writer and anti-war activist Sarah Flanders says it is very likely that Israel was behind the assassination of the senior Iranian scientist, but it would not act without a green light from the United States.
I think it's very likely that Israel is behind this attack, but at the same time, we should note that Israel does not act without the agreement, compliance, enthusiastic support of the U.S. Israel would not dare to. They're absolutely dependent for their very existence, for their political, for their military, for their economic existence on the U.S. So really, Trump sent the message the week before when he openly called for the bombing of Iran, speculated how to start war with Iran. That was the green light, and without it, Israel could not act.
The European Union's foreign policy chief Josep Borrell has expressed optimism that a recalibrated relationship between the 27-nation bloc and the US may lead to the preservation of the Iran nuclear deal. Now, political scientists insist that Israel and US President Donald Trump's administration remain determined to try and prevent this. Jerome Hughes reports.
On Wednesday morning in Brussels, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen chaired a meeting of all 27 EU commissioners. The main item on the agenda was formulating a plan to repair damaged relations with the United States under a Joe Biden presidency. At a press conference following the meeting, we asked if there was fresh optimism in the Commission that the Iran nuclear deal can be saved, despite the best efforts of current US President Donald Trump.
We expect that we can approach these issues in a more coordinated way, in a better partnership.
The same topic was raised by other journalists, but the EU's top diplomat was remaining relatively tight-lipped. During an EU event 24 hours earlier, Josep Borrell was certainly more candid when asked about the assassination in Tehran last Friday of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh.
This was a criminal act.
Expert security analysts are in no doubt that Israel, having had the green light from Washington, was behind the murder. However, many of those who are watching events closely believe efforts to prevent the US from re-engaging with Iran under a Joe Biden presidency will most likely fail.
They have goodwill and good faith. I mean, European Union, Saudi, I mean, so but that's why, I mean, it is really more optimistic about that.
Without going into any details, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell confirmed he spoke with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif on Tuesday. EU officials are said to be on tenterhooks, hoping that tensions in the Middle East don't boil over before Biden can get into the White House. No doubt all of the aforementioned issues will be discussed in detail in 2 weeks' time on the 16th of December, when representatives from the countries involved in the JCPOA will meet in the Austrian capital, Vienna. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Elsewhere, United Nations envoy says 20,000 foreign forces and mercenaries are in Libya despite a ceasefire and a long-standing arms embargo. The UN's interim Libya envoy, Stephanie Williams, called the presence of foreign forces and mercenaries in the country, quote, a shocking violation of Libya's sovereignty. She added that there are 10 military bases in Libya that are either fully or partially occupied by foreign troops. Forces loyal to the UN-recognized government of national accord based in Tripoli and those of strongman Khalifa Haftar in the east formally agreed to a ceasefire in October. The deal calls on all mercenaries and armed groups to leave Libya territory within 90 days. Haftar is supported by Russia, the UAE and Egypt, while pro-GNA forces receive military support from Turkey. And the Ethiopian government has allowed the United Nations to deliver emergency aid to people in the country's flashpoint northern Tigray region under an agreement signed by Ethiopia's peace minister, that is, UN humanitarian personnel and services would have unimpeded, sustained and secure access to Tigray and its surrounding areas. The UN has been warning about a possible humanitarian crisis due to weeks of blockade amid a government military offensive there. The fighting between Federal Army and Tigray People's Liberation Front started on November the 4th. The conflict left hundreds of people dead and thousands displaced, with many fleeing to neighboring Sudan. On Saturday, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed announced the end of military operations, saying federal troops took control of the regional capital. It is 4 years since a Nigerian court ordered for the release of the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, from Abuja. The Nigerian capital, Danjuma Abdullahi, reports that despite this court's judgment, the Islamic cleric has remained in detention.
On December 2, 2016, the Federal High Court in Abuja handed down its ruling ordering the release of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zakzaki and his wife Zinat. The court ruled that the arrest and detention of Sheikh Zakzaki were illegal and unconstitutional, declaring that the rights of the Islamic cleric have been violated. Despite this historic ruling of the federal court, Sheikh Zazaki and his wife have remained in detention.
4 years of misrule, 4 years of disrespect to the Nigerian constitution, 4 years into tyranny, 4 years of tyranny, 4 years of disrespect to Nigerian law, 4 years of disregard to the Nigerian constitution, 4 years to a democracy without rule of law, 4 years to a democracy that has no respect whatsoever to courts in Nigeria.
In December 2015, following a traffic incident, soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked Zazaki's home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters, setting the house ablaze and destroying his property. Three of his sons were among those killed during the attack. Despite several protests in Nigeria and abroad demanding for the release of Sheikh Al-Zazaki and his wife, the Nigerian government has kept a deaf ear. Instead, security operatives have continued to crack down on members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, killing dozens and injuring and arresting many of them. So far, no one has been held responsible for the Zaria massacre, where hundreds were killed.
The panel did not accuse Sheikh Zazaki of anything, and the panel recommended that the people that invaded Malam's house, the Husseiniyah, the Darul Rahma, should be punished. But till date, most of them are being promoted. This is unfortunate at this century.
In addition to ordering for the release of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat, the Federal High Court also ordered the government to pay the sum of 25 million naira, about $66,000 each, to the Islamic cleric and his wife. So far, the Nigerian government has not implemented any of the order of the court. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Israel's ruling coalition is on the verge of collapse as lawmakers have given their parliamentary approval to a bill aimed at dissolving the Knesset. The opposition proposed bill secured 61 votes in favor, with 54 voting against. The move came a day after leader of centrist Blue and White Party Benny Gantz announced that he would break ranks with the governing coalition of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The budget is at the heart of the controversy, with Gantz accusing Netanyahu of dragging out the budget talks to save himself from a corruption trial. The bill, if passed, could force a fourth parliamentary election in less than 2 years. Three previous elections turned out to be inconclusive, as no single party could secure an absolute majority to form a cabinet on its own. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil says the majority of Israelis want Netanyahu to fail in case of another parliamentary election because he is facing fraud charges.
If the Knesset is dissolved, the Israelis will go to the election for the fourth time in 2 years. Israelis are hoping that this time Netanyahu would fail, especially that he's facing charges of fraud and these charges that caused the Israelis to take the streets every week on Saturday night. Israelis, thousands of Israelis demonstrate calling for Netanyahu to leave his seat and calling for a new election. So now Netanyahu would be forced to reach a compromise to accept the budget for the next 2 years. Thus, Gantz would be the Israeli prime minister.
Meanwhile, coronavirus infections are rising rapidly in the besieged Gaza Strip, with hundreds of cases being discovered on a daily basis. The Palestinian health officials struggle to cope with the rising cases amid suffocating Israeli siege on the impoverished enclave. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
The number of coronavirus infections is on the rise in Gaza. Infections have spiked to nearly 22,000 cases since March. Daily hospitalizations due to COVID-19 also continue to rise, bringing the average of serious and critical cases to more than 20% of confirmed cases. Some 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are at the increasing risk of contracting the virus amid a severely depleted healthcare system, which is largely attributable to the Israeli regime's ongoing blockade.
The growing number of infections is exerting a lot of pressure on our health system, which is already in a bad shape because of Israel's blockade. The health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and equipment to combat the deadly pandemic.
Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the devastating outbreak of COVID-19 since March. People in Gaza who recovered from the deadly virus are still traumatized and say they are lucky to be alive.
The coronavirus infection was a horrifying experience. As a photojournalist, I have covered Israeli wars and military bombardments, and honestly, I was much more scared when I contracted the COVID-19 virus. When facing coronavirus, you are facing an unseen enemy. Anyone can get infected, and I have seen young people fighting for their lives in intensive care units.
The pandemic has added to the substantial financial strain already felt by many families living in the Gaza Strip and left a huge negative impact on the economy.
The pandemic started to spread locally in late August, and every day we hear of hundreds of new infections. The pandemic has hurt all businesses, especially small businesses like mine. I have to work every day, and if I don't work, I will not be able to provide food for my family.
Hundreds of Gazan patients have already lost their lives in recent years due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices.
Experts warn that the unprecedented surge in COVID-19 cases in the Gaza Strip will soon overwhelm the under-equipped health sector. The tiny enclave has been under a crippling Israeli blockade since 2007. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The coronavirus pandemic is surging across Europe, with several countries on the continent reporting a steep rise in cases and fatalities. Italy reported 684 more deaths, bringing the total tally to over 57,000. It also reported more than 20,000 new infections. The country has so far registered 1.6 million cases. In the UK, official data showed the number of infections and deaths rose by more than 16,000 and nearly 650 respectively. Turkey reported a record high of number of fatalities with 193 new deaths. The number of infections went up by over 31,000. Turkey has implemented measures including weekday curfews and weekend lockdowns to curb the virus. Germany has also extended its coronavirus restrictions.
We had already made clear in November that unless there were significant positive changes, it was highly likely that the measures in place until December 20 would be extended. Based on this, we agreed today that the goal continued to remain in place to get the incidence numbers below 50 cases per 100,000 inhabitants for 7 days.
Merkel added that Germany has a very high daily number of fatalities, and this shows how big a responsibility the government has to get the pandemic under control. According to the Robert Koch Institute, Germany has so far reported over 1,080,000 coronavirus cases and more than 17,000 deaths. That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The Western Balkans, one of Europe's poorest regions, has for weeks been battling an explosive coronavirus spike. in death toll doubling in the last month alone to reach nearly 10,000. The crisis is exposing gaps in healthcare systems that have long suffered from low funding and a brain drain crisis, with an exodus of promising young doctors and nurses leaving to seek better wages and training abroad. According to the World Health Organization WHO data, even before the pandemic began, the Balkans had some of the lowest density rates of doctors in Europe. Hospitals in the region are now facing further shortages of staff fall victim to the respiratory disease. In Serbia, for example, some 2,000 medical workers have been forced to self-isolate, just as medical wards are seeing a huge inundation of patients filling beds in the capital, Belgrade. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, in North Macedonia and Montenegro are all in Europe's top 10 when it comes to highest per capita death rates on the European continent. We now present you a news report written by staff at Agence France-Presse under the heading Catastrophic, Balkan Healthcare Overwhelmed by Virus Surge. Please stay with us for more of Agence France-Presse's article. Not enough beds and not enough doctors. A skyrocketing coronavirus caseload is pushing hospitals in the Balkans to the cusp of a collapse, in chaotic scenes reminding some medical staff of the region's 1990s wars. After nearly a year of keeping outbreaks more or less under control, the nightmare scenario that the Balkans feared from the start of the pandemic is now starting to unfold. In hard-hit Bosnia-Herzegovina, one doctor described the distress of having to juggle the care of multiple patients whose lives were hanging by a thread. The doctor, who wanted to remain anonymous, told Agence France-Presse, "The situation reminds me of the war, and I'm afraid it could get even worse during the winter." The doctor adding, "We can do the work of three people, but not the work of five." The West Balkans, one of Europe's poorest regions, has for weeks been battling an explosive coronavirus spike, its death toll doubling in the last month alone to reach nearly 10,000. The crisis is exposing gaps in healthcare systems that have long suffered from low funding and a brain drain crisis, with an exodus of promising young doctors and nurses leaving to seek better wages and training abroad. According to the World Health Organization WHO data, even before the coronavirus pandemic began, the Balkans had some of the lowest density rates for doctors in Europe. Hospitals in the Balkans region are now facing further shortages as staff fall victim to the respiratory disease. In Serbia, for example, some 2,000 medical workers have been forced to self-isolate, just as medical wards are seeing a huge inundation of patients filling beds in the capital, Belgrade. Rade Panic, the president of the Serbian Doctors' Union, told regional television channel N1 recently, "I never had such an experience in my professional career." The anesthetist, who works in the red zone of a hospital treating the most serious COVID-19 cases, added, "I didn't have room for patients that were medically considered young. I didn't have anywhere to transport them." Bosnia-Herzegovina, North Macedonia and Montenegro are all in Europe's top 10 when it comes to highest per capita death rates on the European continent. Yet governments in the region have been reluctant to return to the drastic lockdowns imposed at the start of the pandemic, instead opting for lighter restrictions such as early closure of restaurants. While Serbia is racing to build two brand new hospitals, Kosovo is considering adapting old hotels into makeshift hospital wards, including the Grand Hotel in downtown Pristina. Overflowing clinics in Pristina mean that some patients, such as 33-year-old Veprim Morina, are being turned away. The fitness instructor told Agence France-Presse, "The doctor told me to take my medication at home since the hospitals are all full." Veprim Morina managed to hire a nurse to provide treatment at home, an option those who can afford it are opting for when possible. He said getting a hospital bed now requires having connections. He added, "You have to be very lucky to find a place in a hospital." In neighbouring North Macedonia, the government is marshalling private clinics and their staff to treat COVID-19 patients after public hospitals hit full capacity. North Macedonia's Health Minister Venko Filipce said, "We have been providing new beds, but it is harder and harder." Outside clinics in the capital Skopje, relatives of patients bring food and sometimes even medicine to their loved ones. One man seeking information on his sick relative said, "Catastrophic, unorganized, no one answers the phone for hours," adding, "The medical staff are fighting, giving their best, but they simply cannot do everything." Croatia's doctors have also warned of staff and equipment shortages in Croatia's hospitals. They say more than 2,500 patients are currently hospitalized, and 3,000 would push the healthcare system to the edge of collapse. Experts say politicians have struggled to strike a balance between controlling the virus and protecting fragile economies. Croatian economist Ljubo Jurčić said, "We are too poor that all lockdown measures be repeated twice." In Bosnia-Herzegovina, shops, restaurants and gymnasiums all remain open, while Serbia recently cut hours for businesses but has stopped short of an all-out closure. While progress on vaccines is helping doctors hope, they fear the chaos that would unfold in the meantime. Jasmina Smajic, a doctor in the Bosnian city of Tuzla, said, "I don't understand why the authorities don't put in place more restrictive measures." She added, "Something must be done about this if we want to prevent a catastrophic consequences." Meanwhile, a World Health Organization WHO special COVID-19 envoy has predicted a third wave of the pandemic in Europe in early 2021. If European governments repeat what he said was a failure to do what was needed to prevent the second wave of infections. The World Health Organization's David Nabarro said in an interview with Swiss newspaper, "They missed building up the necessary infrastructure during the summer months after they brought the first wave under control." David Nabarro, a British citizen who campaigned unsuccessfully to become the director of the World Health Organization in 2017, said, "Now we have the second wave of coronavirus. If they don't build the necessary infrastructure, we'll have a third wave early next year." Europe briefly enjoyed sinking infection rates that are now surging again. Germany and France on Saturday saw cases rise by about 40,000 combined. Switzerland and Austria have thousands of cases daily, whilst Turkey reported a record 6,000 new infections. David Nabarro singled out Switzerland's move to allow skiing with wearing face masks required in gondolas, as other Alpine nations like Austria have shuttered ski resorts. David Nabarro said Switzerland could reach a very high level of sickness and death. Nabarro was quoted by the newspaper Solothurner Zeitung as saying, "Once the infection rates sink, and they will sink, then we can be as free as we want," he added. "But right now, should ski resorts be open? Under what conditions?" David Nabarro lauded the response of Asian countries like China and South Korea, where infections are now relatively low. people are fully engaged. They take on behaviors that make it difficult for the virus to transmit. They keep their distance, they wear face masks, they isolate when they're sick, they wash their hands and surfaces. They protect the most endangered groups. David Nabarro also said Asia did not relax restrictions permanently and prematurely. He said, "You must wait until case numbers are low and stay low." He added, "Europe's reaction was incomplete."
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us reflect today on a saying bequeathed to us for our guidance from Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him, the 11th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. There are two qualities such that there is no quality above them: faith in Allah and a serving of brothers.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام: لعلك ترى أن الله إنما خلق هذا العالم الواحد، وترى أن الله لم يخلق بشرا غيركم، بلى والله، لقد خلق الله ألف ألف عالم وألف ألف آدم، أنت في آخر تلك العوالم وأولئك الآدميين.
Imam al-Baghir alayhi salam stated, "Perhaps you think that Allah has only created a single world, and you think that Allah has not created anyone other than yourselves. Nay, by Allah, verily Allah has created a million worlds and a million atoms, and you are in the last of these worlds and of the last atoms."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So discussing some of these dialogues and conversations that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam had, we find a very interesting discussion that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has with one of his students by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi. Now, in this discussion between Imam al-Baqir and Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi, we find that Imam al-Baqir gives Jabir some very interesting and very high moral standards and ideals through which humanity and human beings can become perfect. They can become sublime if they are to put them into effect. Now, the following is one of them. Imam al-Baqir says, "Know that you are not our friend when you become sad, when all the people of your city say that you are an evil man." So here Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, before we continue, is saying that if you are one of the friends of the Ahl al-Bayt, then don't become sad when the people of your city or everybody around you says that you are an evil man, when in reality you are a good person. So you are a good person, but for some reason people don't like good people, unfortunately. But you're a good person and still the people of your city call you an evil man. You should not become sad at this. Rather, you should be proud and you should be happy and you should thank Allah that you are a good person. In continuation, Imam al-Baqir says, "If they saw that you are a righteous man, then that should not delight you." Meaning, if the people say that you are so good and you are so pious and we love you so much, that should not delight you. Yes, you should thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for all honor and respect is from Allah. But do not make this praise from the people make you arrogant. And finally, Imam al-Baqir says, "For what people say against you or for you neither harms you nor benefits you." Very beautiful words in this dialogue that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has with his student Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi. We learn so many beautiful lessons from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Just to let you know that when you hear these fatwa from our mujtahideen, you know, people ask this question, "Oh, mujtahids are giving fatwa, where does it come from?" Well, the fatwa in most cases basically are based on the ahadith of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Or even if it's not exactly from the wordings of the ahadith, it is based on the principles derived from the Quran and the Ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. Imam explained it further by saying, "Innama al-infaha bimanzilati dajajatin mayta ukhrijat minha bayda." Imam said, if you want to understand why this rennet, this enzyme known as rennet, is still halal, although it comes from an animal which was not zabiha, Imam says the example would be of an egg which comes from a dead chicken. The chicken was dead, and they cut it up, and they say there is an egg in there. Imam says that is the example. Although the chicken is dead, it was not slaughtered. You can't eat that chicken, but this halal, this egg is okay. So Imam asked him, فَهَلْ تَأْكُلْ تُؤْكَلْ تِلْكَ الْبَيْضَ? Can that egg be eaten? Qatada says, لَا وَلَا أَمُرُ بِأَكْلِهَا. No, because the egg is coming from a mayta, from a dead chicken. So I will not eat it, and I'll not even allow or, you know, give permission for somebody who follows me to eat it. And Imam says, why? Why would you do that? He says, well, because it is coming from mayta, from a dead chicken. So then Imam said, okay, suppose we keep that egg, and it hatches, and there is a chicken coming out of that egg. Are you going to eat that? Chusa jo hai, usko khaoge ki nahi, soup bana ke? And then he says, well, if the egg is hatched and a chick comes out, when a chicken baby comes in from that, yeah, I'll eat that. So Imam said, you know, what made the egg haram and the chicken which came from the egg halal for you? You know, this is how Imam basically explained that although the dead chicken was mayta, but the egg is still okay. Similarly, the cow might be mayta, not zabiha, but the enzyme which is now known as rennet is still halal and pak for us.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Muhammad bin Salman. His name is now more conspicuously tied to the slaying of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi and spearheading the bloody war in Yemen. But that's not what he wanted to be known for in the first place. A few years before he came to power as the Saudi crown prince and the de facto leader of the kingdom in 2017, he established a charity by the name of MISC, or Prince Mohammed bin Salman bin Abdulaziz Foundation, a non-profit foundation with the stated goal of cultivating and encouraging learning and leadership in youth for a better future in Saudi Arabia. MISC was in fact central to the so-called MBS project, aimed at promoting bin Salman as a compassionate leader who cares for the well-being of others. Much to the dismay of the young crown prince, MISC is now engulfed in a spate of scandals, including the Khashoggi hit.
حادث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
The foundation came under suspicion following a lawsuit filed in the U.S. last November, according to which MISC's former Secretary General, Badr al-Assakr, had interactions with two former Twitter employees, namely Ali al-Zabara and Ahmed Abu Amr, both accused of spying on private user data of some Saudi dissidents and passing it to Riyadh. The suit asserted that Assakr had provided gifts, cash payments, and promises of future employment in exchange for non-public information about Twitter users. The two employees, along with Ahmed al-Mutairi, who then worked for the Saudi royal family, tapped data from 6,000 Twitter accounts in the years 2014 and 2015. The aim was to identify, and needless to say, to punish some of the Saudi dissidents who would criticize the kingdom's ruling family on the social media platform. The three men all worked for Assakr, who was back then in charge of bin Salman's charity foundations with a small fortune in his pocket. But that was not the first and last time Assakr, who still continues to have a senior role at MISC, hit the headlines for his non-philanthropic work. Just a few weeks after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the Turkish newspaper Yeni Safak ran the story that the Saudi intelligence officer at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul called Assakr four times the day Khashoggi was killed.
Mohammed bin Salman is not only the absolute ruler of Saudi Arabia, meaning that he controls everything from the functions of the state to murders that are carried out, assassinations that are carried out, to the charitable trust. And we shouldn't be surprised at all that he is still busy trying to brutally murder people. Mohammed bin Salman has not been held accountable in any way for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and we're right now at the anniversary of that.
Critics say beneath the surface of MISC and gentle appearance of its former Secretary General, who happens to head bin Salman's private office, lie dark secrets that dovetail with the Saudi crown prince's real image, not the one burnished by his spin doctors. In the words of director of Freedom Forward, Sanjeev Berry, the crown prince and his henchmen keep trying to present themselves in a positive light. Yet behind the scenes, they spy on dissidents' Twitter accounts and are willing to take a bone saw to anyone who disagrees with them. Initially, a number of big names like the United Nations, the Gates Foundation, Bloomberg, Harvard University, and General Electric sealed partnerships with MISC. But in the wake of the Khashoggi killing, more of them, like the Gates Foundation and Harvard University, cut ties with it.
Mohammed bin Salman, since he came into power, has been trying to sell us an image of himself, like a Disney World version of a Saudi crown prince, one who is a reformer, one who is bringing his country into the modern era. But in reality, he is a brutal dictator who has created the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet in Yemen, who chops off the bodies of journalists, who imprisons women for speaking out against him, or for speaking out, calling for their rights. And so, you know, he's trying to present this Disneyland image, but especially after Khashoggi's murder and looking at heroes like Lujain al-Haklul, who remains imprisoned in Saudi Arabia, we easily see through him, see through this image, and see him for the brutal, bonesaw, misogynist dictator that he is.
The scandalous story of Misk reached its crescendo in August this year, when former Saudi intelligence officer Saad al-Jabri filed a lawsuit in the U.S., alleging that the Saudi crown prince plotted to assassinate him by sending a 50-person kill team, dubbed the Tiger Squad, a few weeks after the killing of Khashoggi. According to al-Jabri, Misk conspired with al-Sakr and bin Salman to covertly recruit individuals to serve as agents and who participated in the hunt for him on U.S. and Canadian soil. The hitmen were offered employment at Misk as a reward for aiding the Crown Prince and Mr. al-Sakr. Concerns about the so-called charitable foundation intensified in September 2017, when people from Misk repeatedly asked one of Jabri's sons for contact details of Jabri himself and his wife, as well as about their residency status in the United States.
Bin Salman is trying to paint himself as this modernizer, as this reformer. We are continuing to expose the Saudi regime for the brutal dictatorship that it is, for the war crimes that it commits. Saudi Arabia this year is hosting the G20 forum, but across the board, mayors of cities across America and across the world who have been invited are canceling. And they are canceling because of the imprisoned women, because of the brutal crackdowns on journalists, on dissidents, because of the brutal war in Yemen.
The Misk case begs this question. If Saudi officials can run spy rings, dismember a journalist, and dispatch a kill team all under the guise of a charity, what can they not do in an all-out military conflict like the Yemen war? Whether these are just the tip of the iceberg or not, Misk Foundation, first and foremost, embodies the Saudi duplicity entrenched in the kingdom's ruling family, where things are not really what they seem.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Two rising stars of the UK Conservative Party see Macron as a model which shows how deeply institutional Islamophobia is embedded in the party, says Peter Aubyn, writer, in an article published under the heading Tory Party's Praise of Macron's Ugly Politics is Shocking. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In normal circumstances, French President Emmanuel Macron is regarded with dark suspicion in Boris Johnson's Brexiteering Conservative Party. This has dramatically changed over the last few weeks. The French president is in danger of turning into a Tory hero. The reason? His response to the recent atrocities in France. Macron's government unveiled a plan to close down the Collective Against Islamophobia in France, CCIF, the largest organization in France that monitors anti-Muslim hate crimes, even though CCIF has no connection to last month's attacks. The decision has been called shocking by Niels Mosenix, Europe Director at Amnesty International. This move could have a chilling effect on all people and organizations engaged in combating racism and discrimination in France, he said. The Muslim charity Baraka City, which likewise has no link to the attacks, has received the same treatment. President Macron has started to use inflammatory language of the kind usually associated with the far right. For example, he referred to the breeding grounds for terrorists in France in a letter to the Financial Times. When Middle East Eye approached the Élysée Palace, it failed to provide evidence to support the president's wild and apparently inaccurate assertion. Crucially, it is not Conservative Party headbangers who have been praising the French president for his response. Tom Tugendhat, chair of the Commons Foreign Affairs Select Committee, increasingly tipped as a future Tory leader, has issued a series of tweets praising Macron's reaction. France's multiple attacks in recent days have drawn an inspiring response from Emmanuel Macron. Macron is defending equal rights for all. We must stand together and stand with France, he wrote in one tweet. This week, Neil O'Brien, MP, another rising star, who was recently appointed head of the new policy group in 10 Downing Street, expressed his admiration for Macron's reaction. Responding to a tweet from Labour MP Zara Sultana that raised concerns about Macron's decision to close CCIF, O'Brien tweeted, "A Labour MP smearing the French president as an Islamophobe for reasserting basic liberal values in the wake of a series of horrific attacks. Grim. We should support the French as they grieve in the wake of these atrocities." Both O'Brien and Tugendhat's unconditional praise of Macron is little short of extraordinary. And O'Brien's statement that Macron is standing up for basic liberal values is absurd. There is a wider context to Macron's recent statements and hardening of policy against Muslims. Rather than asserting liberal values, Macron appears to be trying to appeal to the far right. Recent polls have shown Macron is neck and neck with Marine Le Pen and her far-right National Rally Party. Many analysts see Macron's actions as a way to court right-wing voters in a bid to fend off his most dangerous rival for the presidency. This context makes it especially worrying that two mainstream Tory politicians have come out so publicly in favor of Macron. Remember how Theresa May responded to the terrible Manchester Arena bombing, which killed 23 people 3 years ago. She was low-key and measured. Certainly,